Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined by Tamar Uriel Be'eri. Tamar, do you know which side you're on yet? Are you part of the revolting side? Are you part of the side that's going to be creating civil disobedience in the country? Or are you part of the side that's going to be fighting against that to preserve democracy?
Fighting for the system, yeah. I haven't chosen a side yet. There's kind of a sense of biblical proportions here, and I don't know really which side of the civil war I want to go on yet. But I like to think about it like Hunger Games, you know? Like, am I District 13 or am I District 1?
Okay, I guess, I never saw those movies or read those books. So I don't get the reference, but I'm sure there are many people who do. But we are talking a little cynically and maybe with too much sarcasm about the... But maybe that's the healthiest way to talk about what's going on here. Because just in the last 24 hours... You've had a number of members of the opposition, Benny Gantz, Yair Lapid, and other people, former deputy chief of staff and Knesset member for Meretz, Yair Golan, calling for civil disobedience. Well, not civil disobedience, I want to say that, but massive hafkanot, protests, demonstrations yes. against the government led by Netanyahu and the judicial reforms that they're trying to push through.
Right, and this is what several members of the coalition have labeled as civil disobedience.
Correct. And in response... You have Itamar Ben-Gvir, the new national security minister, who's saying, I'm going to take water cannons to the left-wing protest this coming Saturday night. You have a member of his party, Tzvika Fogel, former brigadier general in the IDF, who says, we need to arrest Yair Lapid and Benny Gantz. I mean, in a democracy, we're talking about arresting the opposition.
The head of the opposition.
Right, former defense minister, guy who was the chief of staff, Benny Gantz. I mean, like, this is where the Israeli rhetoric is. So besides for the fact that we're kind of in the gutter at the moment, which is never a good place to be.
Yeah.
I think it's bad. I mean, there's real talk of this divide that is just growing among Israelis.
Civil war.
Massive. I mean, like, you know, so you and I, right before we started recording this, we watched that great Eretz Nehederet skit.
Yeah, for anybody who doesn't know what Eretz Nehederet is, it's kind of like the Israeli Saturday Night Live. And they had a skit 2 years ago.
They have this character, Shauli, who plays, how would you describe him?
I guess he's just like supposed to be a satirical version of a typical,
like,
Israeli
very rough limit. Mizrahi type of guy. Yeah,
I guess so. Yeah,
it seems that way based on, yeah, I don't know,
based on the character. And he basically is being asked about going to elections, and obviously this is kind of a timeless subject for Israel since we're in elections so much. And he says, I'm not voting anymore, I'm sick of it, I call for a civil war.
Right. And he says even more than that. He says, this is actually, Israel is behind the rest of the world. America had a civil war. Other countries got civil wars. Israel hasn't yet had a civil war. It deserves to have a civil war. And then he goes on saying it's actually an easy war. You don't have to drive anywhere. You just go downstairs in your flip-flops and you pick up a gun.
Yeah.
And it's right beneath your building. I mean, it's very funny.
It's very dark.
But it's very dark. And when you kind of mix that, and it's gone viral again now in recent days,
yeah.
right? Because of all this talk of civil war here in Israel.
Civil disobedience.
But I can't say it's impossible. I mean, you know, I think we are at this point that things could spiral out of control potentially. And I know this clashes with what we said last week, because remember we
tried to stay positive last
week. We said our New Year's resolution is being positive, right? And we're not when we're talking about this. So that's definitely something that I think we have to watch out for, and we have to be concerned. And we have to make sure that we preserve the democratic institutions of this country.
Yes. Actually, speaking of last week's podcast, you remind me that we spoke last week rather comically about Ben-Gvir's visit to the Temple Mount and the suit jacket that he was wearing, which we thought was kind of a tuxedo jacket. So we did receive a response from one of our listeners who said that actually he was wearing a jacket that he had that was a little bit bigger, because he was wearing a bulletproof vest under it. And so his normal suit jackets wouldn't normally fit over it.
So someone just happened to have what looked like a tuxedo jacket.
I don't know if somebody else or he did, but that was what was on hand, I guess.
And we had another question, right? We spoke about our sister publication. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
So our sister publication, and I think I asked why sister, why not brother? And we got an email from Foster Harbin, who is a longtime listener to the Jerusalem Post podcast and a regular reader. And Foster told us that it is actually ancient Greece where this originates. And I'll read from Foster's email. The mythical nine muses were sisters with differing attributes, but all in the written spoken arts. He said, I won't bore you with the details, but that is where the sister publication thing comes from. So
there we go. Open and shut.
Thank God we have our listeners who can educate us a little more. But back to the civil disobedience just for a second. One of the other things that's happened this week is Israel is back to being obsessed with flags, right? You saw the story about the flags. And this comes from the demonstration that took place on Saturday night at the Habima Square in Tel Aviv, where some people waved Palestinian flags. And automatically, that sets off a storm, right?
Correct.
God forbid anyone should wave a Palestinian flag.
By the way, even within the protest groups, there's a large range of political ideologies. And there was internal conflict ahead of the protest because one of the organizations that's more center, maybe even center-right leaning, did put out a safety warning because there would be concerns over safety from some of the attendees. This was taken as like a very racist comment and suggesting that the Palestinian attendees would attempt to harm those around them. So even within that organization, there's a lot of conflict because it's still a wide range of opinions, but it shows also that there's a wide range of opinions that are unilaterally opposing the judiciary reforms. That was what the protest was about. But yes, there were Palestinian attendees waving Palestinian flags, or supporters of the two-state solution waving Palestinian flags. And
there's nothing to get a right-wing Israeli going than that. And to me, I've always mystified me to an extent. Like, this is what we're so concerned about, the flag. I think and I want to tie it into a couple of things. First of all, who cares, right? Let people wave flags. What does it make a difference? And by the way, can you imagine, so it's got the red, green, black, and white on the Palestinian flag. Now, have you ever seen the Emirati flag? Or I think maybe it's the Kuwait flag. There's a bunch of flags that also have these different colors and like different shaped triangles with like this color first.
Yeah, and the difference is very small.
Very small. So imagine like they start to wave an Emirati flag and the police come and take it down. Right. Whatever. So number one, you're setting yourself up for just like stupid mistakes. Number two is, why do we care so much? Number three, there's freedom of speech. And that should allow you to wave flags. Right. Number four, Israel is the one who signed the Oslo Accords with the Palestinian Authority. We recognize them as an entity and a partner for peace. Why are we now trying to rip down their flags? And basically what's happening, Ben-Gvir has given police the authorization to go to the demonstration this coming Saturday night and to take away flags.
Right. I think that some of the misperception surrounding the flags is that waving a Palestinian flag suggests opposition to the state of Israel's existence. And I think that's kind of a logical fallacy that's constantly being made surrounding that. One doesn't necessarily mean the other. Several of the more left-wing supporters of a Palestinian state believe in a two-state solution.
Sure.
And don't believe in, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. If it were an opposition, a unilateral opposition.
I love
opposition,
the way that rhymes. It's like,
well, I think that's kind of the point.
That was the point of that. Yeah.
Just anyway.
Whoever did that got that right.
Yeah. Great poetic form, guys.
But the people who wave the flags who are supporters of the two-state solution, they're not denying the existence of the state of Israel. And also, do you remember Shirin Abu Akleh? How could we forget? The Al Jazeera journalist who was killed during an IDF terrorist shootout in Jenin just a few months ago. At her funeral, when the coffin was being taken out of St. Joseph's Hospital in East Jerusalem to be buried, some people were waving Palestinian flags. Israel Jerusalem police came in with bats and started to beat some of the pallbearers themselves. The coffin almost freaking fell on the ground, right? As the whole world is watching because of a stupid Palestinian flag. I mean, we need to grow up. Seriously. This is not the issue.
This can't be the source of our problem right now, is this imagery that is being potentially taken out of context. And, of course, I'm sure some of the people who are carrying a Palestinian flag are opposed to an Israeli state. But is this really where we're going to start armed conflict? We're going to start, physical controversy, and especially in the example that you brought up at a literal funeral.
By the way, thank God that Netanyahu was appointed Galit Distil, a Likud member, as the Sarat Hasbara, as the public diplomacy minister. Because if on Saturday night, let's say 300 people come with Palestinian flags, which if I was planning that protest, I would recommend they do that just to challenge the police. And then the police come in and start to grab the flags. And that's going to be broadcast and those pictures will be shown all over the world.
That's not going to make us look too good.
Yeah, but we have her as our Hasbara minister, so she'll be able to explain it. presumably.
I don't see where you're going with this.
Oh, I'm just being cynical.
Oh, okay.
Of course you won't be able to explain it, but this is crazy Israel.
Yeah, this doesn't really, you know, I don't know how this is going to go down on the international front, but until now, there's a lot of concern about the international front's response to what's happening in Israel, especially with the current coalition, and I don't know that this is going to help so much.
It's not going to help, and I think what we can do is try to call on the government, the opposition, and everyone to just chill a little, right?
Chill a little.
Chill a little. Take it down.
Official advice from the Jerusalem Post.
Just
take a
notch,
chill pill, man.
Take a chill pill. I mean, we called last week, and I wrote this piece about how Israel should, we should let the new government govern. And I actually got a lot of flack for it. Some people who said, you know, you can't now just suddenly become right wing. I wasn't becoming right wing. I wasn't left wing before, but I was just trying to give nuance. And or people who are on the left who said, oh, you're betraying the cause because you're saying let this government govern. I'm like, I'm not part of your cause. I'm just a journalist writing a piece.
And I think that you were saying something that we were kind of talking about last week is judge the government by policy, not personality. Let's wait and see what comes out and oppose the specific policies that come out should they need to be opposed by one's opinion or standards.
100%. Look, there's a lot to talk about, and we'll have to wait to see what happens with this coming government, what they do, the judicial reforms, and what's going to be the response to it. But listeners, stay tuned, because this story is going to be with us for a while.
Yes.
And as we speak, it's not going in a positive direction, even despite your and I efforts, Tamar, to hold to our New Year's resolution
and stay positive.
Of staying positive. But we have a positive person we've interviewed this week.
Yes.
And at least that. So on this week's episode with Dr. Yosefa Fogel-Rubel, who holds a BA from Stern College for Women at Yeshiva University in Judaic Studies and Creative Writing. She has a teaching degree in Tanakh from Herzog College. She's a graduate of Matan's Tanakh Scholars Program. And she's completed master's and doctoral studies at Bar-Ilan University in the Bible department. And she runs a great podcast that I've had the chance to listen to, Through Matan, which is basically women talking about the parasha, women talking about the Torah portion. Almost every week she's on with another very distinguished woman, a scholar, lecturer, teacher, to talk about the different dynamics and stories of our ancient Bible and the Torah. And we thought we'd talk with her this week because this Shabbat, we start a new book, the Sefer of Shemot, the book of Exodus. And we discover and are introduced to the man who will eventually lead the Jewish people. And that is Moshe, Moses. And
through civil revolt.
Through a sort of civil revolt. There you go. Look at how it all comes around. So with that said, we're going to talk a little about leadership, about what it means, about the stories and the lessons that maybe that can be learned from this amazing story and be applied to us today. Here we go. So Yosefa, it's great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. Thank you for joining us. And I've been listening to the Matan Parsha podcast. So first, a compliment. And maybe a disclaimer, my wife Chaya is the CEO of Matan, so that's very much why I'm listening to it, although I'm sure there are other people who listen to it as well, but I found it very enjoyable and at a level that I think a lot of people can understand. But maybe before we dive in, why don't you just tell us a bit about the podcast, what its purpose is, how often does it come out, things like that.
Sure. First of all, I'm so glad you're listening, and it's definitely something that's evolved. The truth is that the podcast actually came into being during one of the corona lockdowns in my extra bedroom. And basically, it started off as I've been working in Matan for the past 13 years. Matan's a women's learning institution with a main branch in Jerusalem and Ra'anana and other branches around Israel. It actually started off as a conversation with a number of women about their journey into the world of Torah learning. After we did a series on that, we did a series on women writing Torah works. So all different, very, very diverse kinds of books and different contributions to the Torah world. And after that, we moved sort of into a series about different topics. We did a series on suffering in Jewish sources. We did a series on biblical characterization, again, with different Matan educators. And basically, exactly a year ago, for Parshat Shemot, we sort of changed our format, and we went into half hour weekly Parsha conversations. These conversations are always between me and a different guest. Every week there's a different guest. There are some who return over different books, but every week it's somebody else. I'm pretty strict about my 30 maximum sort of like 35 minutes of conversation. And really the point of the podcast is to, first of all, really converse. It's not someone giving a shiur. It's not someone giving a class or a frontal lecture, but really have conversations about the Parsha in ways that really open up. Again, these are texts that to some are more familiar or less familiar, but to really open them up for conversation. And for example, in the book of Bereishit, we really just focus now on interpersonal and family dynamics in the book of Bereishit, asking like really, really the tough questions of how is it that at the root of the Jewish people, we have sort of a lot of jealousy and difficult marital dynamics that, you know, I wouldn't wish upon myself or anyone I know. And we really sort of dive deep into the complex family dynamics in the book of Bereishit, speaking about Joseph and his family and how that develops over time, and always with some sort of import into our life or the way we're living, but really deeply rooted in the text itself. That's a very important principle, both in the world of Matan's learning, which is really a world of in-depth scholarship and textual analysis, which of course brings in commentaries as well. But that's really the anchor with, of course, the way we can think about how this impacts our life, reflects truths that our lives, of course, also surround. And now as we open for the book of Shemot, which is, again, there's something we've sort of completed our first cycle. We're focusing on identity and nation and nationality formation, essentially, and really trying to...
So can you delve a bit more into that, please? I'm curious what you're referring to in terms of identity and stuff like that as we're entering the new Sefer Shemot.
Yeah, so I think that what we're trying to do is to pick a theme that really lies at the root of these books. And last year, when we first began, we actually chose our prism as each episode focused on a particular commentator. So we highlighted a personality and highlighted a particular perspective they had on something in the week's Parsha. Now we're really looking at the broader themes that underscore each book. So the book of Shemot is really the book in which we develop our identity as a people, and really sort of lay out what is the national DNA, what we're aspiring to do, what are the missions that God has given us as a people. And so because that's really at the root of the book of Shemot, I really want to try and sort of tease out that theme in all of the parshiot. And it comes up in different ways, in different aspects of the book. So yeah. I think even if you just look at the book of Shemot, it can really be divided into three broad stages. You have first the story of the Exodus, our time in Egypt. And then we move sort of after chapter 12, we move into the Sinai experience, which is abroad. It's not a one moment thing. There's laws that are given before, laws that are given after, but it all sort of surrounds this moment and revelation at Sinai. And after that, we really have a unit that surrounds the erection of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle. And so we have there three formative experiences as a people. First, we have, again, our where we emerged from. We have the charges we're given legally, the way we're supposed to live morally. And then our third stage is to build a home, is to build a home that really is supposed to translate those principles that we've come out with from those first two sections into a home that we'll share with each other, and that we'll also share with God. So that sort of movement of these three sections is something that we're trying to follow and develop as those visions develop throughout the Parshiot.
So I think there's, you know, a lot of interesting things just about the Torah in general, but and obviously the stories, but one of the ways that I definitely read it in today's modern age, and I'm sure many people do as well, there's nothing unique in this, but it's about looking at, you know, you mentioned even the stories of the last book of Genesis and the stories of Abraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov and their children and the dynamics between the family. And, you know, there's the famous saying from the, I guess it's probably the Talmudic period, or you'll correct me, of Maaseh Avot Siman LaBanim, right? What the actions of our fathers are kind of lessons for the sons, for the children. But that includes the good and the bad, right? There's good that they did, and there's also, sadly, as in every human being, because everybody's human, there's bad, and we're meant to learn from that as well. So I definitely think that that's a great approach for reading these kind of texts. And I'm curious, when you look at Shmot, we were joking before, we spoke before in our introduction on the podcast about all this talk right now that's taking place in Israel, and I'm not trying to pull you into political discourse, but about civil disobedience and civil war, and, you know, everyone now, that's the hot topic at the moment. And Tamar kind of jokingly said, oh yeah, Sefer Shmot, a civil revolt by the Jews in Egypt, right? And it was just interesting kind of how, you know, you can really create these comparisons oftentimes between our lives today and the lives back then. So I don't want to pull you into politics, but when you look at the bigger theme, just in general, the relationship that we as readers or as Jews should have with the Torah, is that the type of relationship we're supposed to have? One where we can think about our daily lives through this ancient text?
So I think that that is a wonderful question. And I think that the answer is actually similar, whether or not the Jew asking themselves this question exists in the religious world or not in the religious world. If I could take an example of a non-religious orientation, one of the biggest gifts to humanity in my eyes in the past few years is the commentary of Leon Kass. It came out a year and a half ago, where he after, I think it was around 20 years, where his commentary came out on the book of Bereshit, he has now a commentary on the book of Shmot. And I will say that for somebody with a less religious orientation as he had, he read the book of Shmot, trying to figure out what it's trying to teach me. And he's unbelievably erudite, and he had basically learned with people for over 20 years before writing this book. And for me, one of the deepest explorations of the book of Shmot have actually emerged from what he wrote and came out with last year. And I think that, yes, meaning we read the Torah, whether or not it translates into legal, halachically binding living, is something that we're supposed to do. The Torah is here to teach us something. The question is how we bridge that with our world today. Rabbi Sacks says in a number of places that a fundamentalism is taking a text without using bridges to our modern world, meaning it's very dangerous to take, I think, any given chapter in the book of Shmot and say, oh, well, this is what's happening today and this is how we should behave. There's a reason why there are thousands of years of tradition of commentary and thinking out loud about what these texts have to say. So I would be very careful with any orientation as to how we translate that into our world. Do I think that all of us, really incumbent upon us, is to read these texts and say, what is the moral, religious, spiritual DNA that we're being told is at our foundation? Yes, I do think that that is an imperative and that it can illuminate conversations, but we all know that texts can be read in all different kinds of ways. So that can lead to all different kinds of results and responses. But I do think that's basic to the way that Torah is supposed to be studied. It's fun to think of it as an intellectual exercise, but certainly for the religious reader, and I think that I would say, again, in the name of Leon Kass, who does it beautifully, stating at the outset that he's not a religious reader, that there is so much instruction that the modern life and the modern world we live in today can still take from specifically the world of Shmot when it comes to leadership and moral living and a lot of boundaries that have sort of been broken down in our world in the past few generations.
So you were just saying, actually, when you talk about leadership, I'd kind of like to focus in on that, especially when we're talking about Sefer Shmot and we're talking about, you know, Moshe and his personal evolution, but also his decision to kind of become a leader of these people and bring them out, like perform this exodus. What would you say that we can learn today from his style of leadership as it's presented in the story?
Well, I think that to really understand Moshe, we actually have to think a little bit broader about Shmot itself. So I'm going to take us a step back and then I'll bring us back into Moshe. Shmot can really be understood, I think, through a number of prisms, but actually, one of them connects to the question you previously asked me, and then the other one connects to this question about Moshe. The first is that Shmot is really a book in many ways about power. Again, if someone wants to read more about this, I highly recommend Rabbi Sacks' commentary, his introduction to the book of Shmot. I'll just read one quick quote because I'll really go deeper onto your question about Moshe. But he says that in his introduction to the book of Shmot, the Exodus narrative is a critique of the politics of power, empires, hierarchical societies, and the division of population into free human beings and slaves. The Torah proposes a different kind of politics, based not on power, but on covenant, the free arrangement of a free people who accord absolute sovereignty to God alone. Now, this sort of harks back to the question you just asked me about how the Book of Shemot can connect to the way we look at leadership today. I think that one of the, again, the most well-spoken voices on that topic really was Rabbi Sacks in his Parsha Explorations, which is that Sefer Shemot comes to say something that actually sits at the root of Western society today. But I think, again, in light of all of the complications that we're seeing in our world today with our leadership, there are a lot of lessons there that will be helpful to review as we move forward. Specifically regarding Moshe, is that another central prism for understanding Shemot is Shemot as actually a birth story. What do I mean about that? Even just on a basic level, the people of Israel are birthed throughout this process. Meaning we have our sort of building blocks in the Book of Bereishit, but we become a people, we become a nation in the Book of Shemot. We leave the family setting and go on to the national and then ultimately international playing field. And even just the basic metaphor of the Jewish people leaving Egypt through a canal of water, essentially, is in its most basic form a birth image of being birthed through water.
I never thought of that. That's interesting. Yeah.
I may be thinking about this more because I'm pregnant, but beyond that, it's an image that I think about often. There's a lot of Midrashim shame that reflects this idea. And after that, what happens is that when we go into the desert, so first we're sort of toddlers and that God does everything for us. And that's really what we see throughout the Book of Shemot. And then the Book of Bamidbar is actually our teenage years. That's the rebellion. It's the testing. And we only really become independent in the Book of Yoshua, perhaps at the end of the Book of Yoshua. But there's this sort of a developmental process that happens. But it's actually a bit more complicated than just being birthed, because if we talk about the Book of Shemot as sort of our origin story, then it's more complicated than that, because we actually were born and raised in Egypt. And then God says, I don't like the way you were brought up. Okay. I don't like the hierarchical society you were brought up in. I don't like the morality that is reflected in Egyptian society. And so we actually go through a process where we're rebirthed in the Book of Shemot. And God says, even just famously in the opening chapter of the Book of Shemot, I'll translate the pasuk, "Uvnei Yisrael paru veyishrtzu veyirbu veyatzmu be'me'od me'od veyatimaleh ha'aretz otam," that we multiplied and multiplied. And the words that are used are, they hark back to the Book of Bereishit, where we have the insects that proliferate so much in the creation of the world in the first chapter in Bereishit. And here we have that description of the people of Israel. So we get this feeling, this is just from a literary example, that we're being created again. And more than that, we have to go through this re-education process. And that's sort of the plagues on one leg, is this idea of re-educating, of overthrowing the Egyptian pantheon, of showing that this is not really the correct model of power that I want to really inculcate into the Jewish people. And we go through this process of receiving new laws and really rebuilding the foundations. And we're reminded so many times throughout the Torah that we should remember what life was like in Egypt so that we don't ever behave that way again. And that difficult process of re-education makes us more empathic towards the weaker members of society, towards the ger, towards the outsider and the widow. And why have I given this as an introduction to your question about Moshe? Because Moshe undergoes a parallel process as the people of Israel. What happens? Moshe as well is raised as an Egyptian. He's raised by an Egyptian mother. And at the same time, he is already imbued, we know from a young age, we don't know why, but already in the second chapter, he's aware of the fact that he's an outsider. Somebody obviously told him at some point. And so he's raised as an Egyptian, but he's aware that he actually has an internal deeper calling to the Jewish people. And that childhood of his enables him at once to have a certain healthy distance from the people who later lead, right? They didn't raise him. They didn't see him in his diapers. But at the same time, he also has Egyptian know-how, which will be really important, right? For knowing how Egypt works so that he can have influence over and against Paro. And he also, like the Jewish people, has to adopt this really empathic stance. And those are those little vignettes that we have about Moshe in the second chapter of Shemot before he's chosen, where he kills the Egyptian and he sees two Israelites fighting. And then he sees Midianite women who aren't even connected to him by any nationality, and he wants to save them as well. And so he also goes through a process like the Jewish people where he is raised in Egypt, but he actually slowly has to sort of make his way back to a different kind of morality, which is the kind of morality that God wants all the people to imbibe. So that's sort of my initial thoughts about Moshe based on his origin story. And his origin story, again, beautifully parallels our origin story, but of course it happens in an accelerated rate because he's going to have to lead us through our story. He's going to have that growth already sort of under his belt before he can also sort of midwife that growth for the people themselves.
So I just want to, as we wrap up, one last question on just the study of Tanakh in today, in definitely in Israel, in the education system. You have children, I have children. Tamar will one day, please God, have children. And I mean, my feeling is that our kids are not getting the right level of education. They're not studying this the right way. And we've seen there were reforms that came out last government and now have already been canceled this government with regards to matriculation exams that pertain also to the study of Tanakh and Torah. Do you feel that Israel or Israelis are literate? There's enough Tanakh literacy in this country, or does that need to be improved?
I definitely do not think there's enough literacy as a broad statement in the country, of course.
Sorry to interrupt, but I'm tying this back to what we said before, because there's so much, obviously it's the story of our people, but secondly, yeah, is that there's so much that you can learn from here that applies to our current lives that I feel we're not experiencing for some reason.
So I guess I'll say two things. One of them is going to sound maybe, I don't know, somewhat elitist, but I think that one of the biggest takeaways from the book of Shemot, and that we certainly are supposed to remember once a year at Pesach, is that as parents, we're supposed to be educators. Now, I know that it sounds easy for me. I teach Torah, but I don't mean that everybody has to be a Torah teacher. It's part of our duty as parents. You know, when people complain about the school systems, which again, depending where you're living, what sect of society you're functioning in, obviously the school system looks different. And as parents, we make decisions about where to send our schools, so we send our children to school. But I guess I often find myself saying to people, and I'll say especially even Olim who come to Israel and have a very hard time moving from their private system that they were a part of, again, that's in a religious worldview, to the system here, I say, school is nice. School's important. I agree with you that it's important for the country to have a certain baseline, and that is going to be a serious mark of what our values are as a society. And that can always be improved. And yes, I agree that the general knowledge base in Israel today, when it comes to our books, again, no matter what your orientation is unimpressive and underwhelming. But at the same token, I do believe that it is our responsibility as parents to educate as well. And that means, you know, reading stories with our children, reading books with our children, educating ourselves. And, you know, even in the most religious of settings where there's many hours a day of learning, that I don't think really exempts any parent from trying to make those honest connections and takeaways for themselves and having those conversations with children. So I agree that the country has to have a certain baseline, and that's important. But I also feel that sometimes we forget that it's our role as parents. And I get it. I'm super tired. I have a whole bunch of them at home. It's not necessarily the thing I'm running to do at 7 o'clock in the evening, but it's something that I think is critical. And if we can circle back to Sefer Shemot, we're being taught in Sefer Shemot that it's our job to be educators. And so we say it formally once a year on the night of Pesach, but I think that it's really a call forever throughout the entire year that's really one of our duties as parents in this world. And we can't outsource that, certainly not completely, to an external system, which again, doesn't give the external system an excuse to be mediocre. There's a lot of mediocrity and it can be made better. But I also think that as parents, sometimes we've lowered our bar too much as well.
It's an important point. And we want to thank you very much, Yosefa Fogel-Rubel, who is the host of the weekly Matan Parsha podcast, One-on-One. Listeners, you can find it on all those different podcast players that you listen to us through. You can also listen to them. Recommended. You got a taste today on what that will be like. So Yosefa, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this week's Jerusalem Post podcast. You can find us, as always, on Google, Apple, Spotify, and all those other places that podcasts are to be played. And we look forward to having you next week and joining us for a real great episode. We have a star interview with Nissim Black, the Jewish, Israeli, American, African-American, I don't know how to describe him, rapper. Talks about his life, his journey, and how he creates music. So you'll want to come back next week. Take care.